Since our interview with my good friend Peter and Mididier, the government of Joseph Kabila has turned off cell and internet service in the Congo. Ubuntu Radio is pleased to be a voice in this struggle for liberation and justice in the Congo. And now, part one of my interview. Telema,
Telema,
Le bien Congolais.
Most High, I come to you giving you thanks and praise for keeping me in sound body and mind. I ask you to forgive me for all my indiscretions, all that I have done and all that I will do. I ask you to open me up, use me as your vessel, let my voice be yours. Speak your mission through me, allow the listeners to open up and receive it the way you intended. No holds barred. Use me. I look at the news and I watch other people's nations formed over.
All right, today on Ubuntu Radio, I'm very fortunate and very lucky to have one of my good friends, Peter. And again, it's only first names on Ubuntu Radio. But Peter's somebody I've known, we just realized, for about almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years.
And again, one of the reasons I wanted to do Ubuntu Radio, and I've wanted to do Ubuntu Radio for a while now, was to have these sort of conversations with people I've known for so long. I think I know them. I don't know if I know them. I know bits and pieces of photographs I've seen on Facebook, bits and pieces of conversation I've overheard. And he just reminded me that we sat down when my son was born, so it had to be within 11 years, on our way to a rinky-dink field and playing a rinky-dink tournament. And we were talking about the book I was writing, and we were talking about, you know, his history. So I knew bits and pieces, but to put the story together, we haven't really had a chance to do that. And this is why I wanted to do this. I know 30, 40 guys in rotation and pickup.
More than that.
I know so little about everybody. And the thing is, our stories are similar. We're all from foreign. We're all, you know, immigrants to this country. So our stories are linked. They're intertwined and they're very similar, but we never really get to discuss them. And so I'm very glad that you decided to come here today to not only share your story, but also to enlighten folks about what's going on in the place where you were born, in Congo, formerly Zaire, formerly Republic of Congo, formerly Belgium.
Belgium, Congo.
So we're going to talk to Peter about that. And also, I'm joined by one of Peter's friends. Actually, just a little background about this week. One of our mutual friends, a guy named Jonas, posted a video, and it had to be no more than 10, 15 seconds long, about some people running through the streets of I have no idea where, and there's smoke. Not through the streets, it was like an alleyway. Mm-hmm. Older people, and I remember specifically older women and men, like people who seemed like they were just roused out of bed and they're just running from gunfire and smoke. I'm going, what's going on? And then I follow that, and I go to Peter's page, and he's posting something in French, I have no idea what it says, but I figured it's about this, because I know every time I see him put that profile picture on the Congolese flag, I know some ish just went down in the Congo that he wants people to know about. Mm-hmm. So I basically want to find out what's going on, and I obviously did some research online. I'm going, this stuff is it's happening. You know, we had 2-3 months of, I'd call it, civil unrest in some parts of the United States, noticeably in St. Louis, in New York, and popping off in other enclaves as a protest to those decisions about police brutality. So this is not an issue that's just going on in the Congo. Obviously, the severity of it changes from the Congo to the United States, but it's about people trying to change a system, trying to change an ideology. So if you try to find some sort of tie-in, the same thing is happening here. We're gonna mention regime changes. In any other part of the world, people say there's a regime change. Well, there's a regime change that just happened in the United States of America. There's a Republican-controlled Congress and Senate. We don't call it regime change, but by God, it's a regime. Yeah. If it was happening in some African Republic, people go, my God, there's a power change of power, and we got to be worried about what's going to come out of this country. So it's not foreign. It's not foreign. So we're going to come into all those things. But like I mentioned to him, you know, one of the first things that people got to know before you bring ideas, people got to know about you. Your story. So we're gonna talk to Peter, have him talk about his story. And he's also joined by,
hey guys, I'm Yedidia.
Oh, you gotta say that again.
It's Yedidia.
Yedidia. I posted on Peter's Facebook, Peter, we gotta come in and talk about this. Yes. And not 2 seconds later, my man Yedidia, that I never met the man until today, says, I wanna be there.
Yep.
You know, I looked at his pictures on his page and he's He's got a lot of pictures where he's in front of a crowd talking, so I don't know if he's a preacher, but I think he's an activist. He's an activist of some kind, obviously, who wants to talk about these issues. So today on Ubuntu Radio, we're with Yedidia and my friend Peter. We're going to talk the history. We're going to segue that into what's going on in the Congo right now and why is that important to us right now. So, Mr. Peter, you got here in 1997.
I got here in 1997, yes.
And from where? From where were you coming from?
Congo Kinshasa. Or, as people like to call it, differentiated from the other Republic of Congo, it's the Democratic Republic of Congo, to be specific.
Okay, formerly Zaire.
Formerly Zaire.
Democratic
formerly,
Republic.
Formerly the Republic of Congo, formerly the Belgian Congo. Okay. So, formerly the private property of King Leopold of Belgium. So,
and we're gonna get into some of that history later.
Yeah.
So you came here from there, 1997. How old?
I was 17.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. And we're gonna get into it, but there was some political unrest going on at that time.
Yes.
But you're telling me that your family wasn't escaping that unrest per se.
No, not per se, because my father, because of his work. Working with the U.S. State Department. So when I was born, my father was in the embassy in Kinshasa, and that's where I grew up. And because of the different issues between the, you know, family issues.
So did you go to like an American school?
No, my mother wanted me to go to a French school because most of the African philosophers or most of Africans who wrote books, their books were translated in French.
Okay.
So she really wanted me to be aware of the African culture, not necessarily the Congolese, but the African culture, because she knew that eventually I would end up in this country.
So the plan was always in place to try to move the family here?
As a matter of fact, I was going to be born in the US because of my father's role, because my father started working with the US government ever since he was 19.
Okay.
So he had me when he was 34. So it was a possibility that I was going to be born here. My mother and father had to stay in Kinshasa, where I was born, of course, in a university hospital where, as a matter of fact, people got killed this week. I was born in the hospital where people got killed.
How many folks died this week?
They're telling us 53, but there's always a possibility of the number being way, way over that. As a matter of fact, the government is not even admitting that there were that many people that got killed there.
What did your father do for the American Embassy?
He was an accountant, but he was a budget specialist who used to balance budgets for the different American embassies in different areas. He was mostly in Sub-Saharan Africa, but whenever there were issues in other embassies around the world, they called my father. He was always traveling, so he was in these different embassies in different parts of the world. For most part of my life, he was not there physically.
Gotcha.
He was not there physically, but my mother played such a big role of being, you know, the mother and trying to play that fatherly kind of role, but, you know, they got a divorce because, of course, of my father's work.
Mother and father divorced, father's working for the American Embassy, mom is just holding it down, trying to make sure that you get a good Francophone education. You speak French, parlez vous français?
Oui, je parle français. Oui, je parle français, je n'ai pas autre choix. J'ai passé beaucoup de temps dans les...
Well, don't show up now. Se hablo español.
Guapoquito.
Se hablo español right here.
Poquito español.
But it's cool, man, when I'm playing ball with all you guys, anybody could just pick up a language.
Yes.
Because we got French, we got
Arabic, we got Spanish,
we got tons of native languages.
Yeah.
When we play ball, you can be cussed out in any language. You just don't know, but everybody says pass me the ball in English.
Exactly.
Everybody says pass me the ball
in English. We got to find a common ground in English.
Were there other siblings, or are you an only child?
Well, from my father and mother's union, I'm the only child.
Okay.
I'm the only child, but you know, my father got remarried two or three more times. And my mother got remarried, of course, she stayed in her marriage, the marriage where she stays, she stays up to this day. She had 10 kids after me.
Wow,
so,
man.
Yeah.
But you were the first. You're the first winner.
I am the first.
Number one. That's a lot of responsibility.
Big brother.
That's a lot of responsibility.
And that's why my heart bleeds, because only one of my siblings are here. He's with me in the U.S. He's in
Dallas, Texas.
But all of them are back home. As a matter of fact, the child whose picture you saw on my wall, who got shot in the neck, there's a picture
that I saw on your wall. Yes. It looked like somebody took a machete and just chopped out the person's back. Is it
that? No, that's another one. There was one that I put before that. There was a kid.
Looked like in the hospital. Yeah. On the floor.
That child. My brother was standing next to him. My younger brother, my 20-year-old brother, was standing next to him. So he is one of the neighborhood kids, one of my brother's friends, who just got killed. So this thing is, like, it hits. Yeah, that's him. That's Gabi. So that right there hits right at home. So all these things, it is like right at home. Like, right at home.
What is your story about, you know, the United States and your connection to the Congo right now?
Oh, wow. First of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to come here. I mean, I've known Peter for quite a few years now, but we haven't got this close.
Yeah.
But I can see just the passion that he has for the motherland.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we share. Almost like him, I came here when I was 16. I came here in 2004.
Okay.
Yes.
From Kinshasa or from where?
Yes.
Okay.
Directly from Kinshasa. It was eight of us. Eight of us. We came here. Actually, we went to Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
And that's where I've lived since.
Okay. The family said, we're getting out of this political unrest, all this stuff that's going on there, or like Peter, was it just some other reason?
Yes. Political unrest was one of the reasons, because my father was also involved in politics and the opposition. Of course, he was against against the regime that was in place in denouncing, but of course he found himself many times in trouble.
Okay.
So it was time to start protecting the family. But also we came here because we wanted to pursue a further education.
Okay.
And also to have a guaranteed future.
Gotcha.
Because the thing with the Congo is you can live the life today, but your future is just in balance.
Peter's told us a little bit about his memories about in Kinshasa,
mm-hmm.
going to French school. What are your memories? Because you would have left 7 years.
7 years after.
7 years.
Mm-hmm.
What I know about the history of Congo is that there was a period of, what do you say, civil war?
Yeah.
More or less, from 96 to about 2003.
Yeah, it was kind of on and off, yeah.
So Peter, you leave right at sort of the beginning, the end of the first Congo War, like around 1996, 97. And then you leave at the end of a civil war that ends, I think, well, at least with the election of Kabila the first? It ends with the election of Kabila the first, or Kabila the second? The second one.
No, Kabila the second. Because Kabila the first, when he came in power, I'm sorry to interrupt, mm-hmm. but this was your part. But Kabila the second, Kabila the first got assassinated in 2001.
Okay.
So, when he got assassinated, because of course there was some unrest going on the eastern part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So there was really, the war really never stopped, because when he came to power, the people that had put him in power, they kind of turned against each other.
Right, the people that put the power said, you gotta go.
Right, they wanted a big part of the cake. Mm-hmm. They wanted, because they were on the table, there was a big, in American way, there was a big pie.
Correct.
And everybody wanted a slice of that pie, and wanted the biggest slice. And so as a result, they started going.
But as one has to go back to try to understand, why is it that they turned against him? It was because, first of all, when Mobutu was in power.
But before we get to that, so mm-hmm. just to give people sort of a historical context,
mm-hmm.
and without sounding like a two-hour history class, we start off with the fact that Congo Kinshasa was more or less a private playground, private property
mm-hmm.
yes. of King Leopold. And can you guys go into that in terms of the history mm-hmm. itself?
Okay. And we usually start in 1885
okay.
with the Berlin Conference, which. Okay. Originally, the name was the Congo Conference.
Okay.
Why? Because once again, you have the Western powers that were fighting against the Congo. So they got together and said, guys, the Congo is big. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, Africa is big. Mm-hmm. Why are we just fighting over the Congo? Why can't we sit down and just
divide it to ourselves?
So yeah. The Africa that we know today is actually the Africa that was charted in 1885.
Okay.
And during that time, the King Leopold II of Belgium was able to secure the Congo as his own and private property.
So the entire country was basically his house.
He had people on the ground who will go in different
villages,
villages, and sign some papers to give them over the territory. But for them, it was more of a genuine exchange.
Okay.
And that's how he was able to get all the signatures and present it to the Berlin Conference as the rightful owner of the Congo.
So we have the same thing here with Manhattan being bought from the Indians for some clam shells. Those Indians get the property value from Manhattan now, that they'll be all right. So this is 1885. Mm-hmm. So one of the major things that happens turn of the century is the production of automobiles.
Yeah, exactly.
And what you need for automobiles? Well, you need wheels. What you need for wheels, you need rubber. And then besides all the innumerable resources that are still under the ground in the Congo now,
mm-hmm.
rubber becomes gold.
Yes.
In the turn of the 1900s.
Yep.
So what happens there? So he starts basically forcing people to
every place had to have they had a quota. They had to meet a quota. If you don't meet a quota, they come up, they start cutting off arms.
Yeah, man. If you just take an internet search and some of the most horrific pictures you will see from colonization in Africa, ones that came out of the Congo.
Yeah.
You see people with just whips and scars on their backs to just.
But that was the reality. That was the reality. That's why they opposed it, because Henry Ford needed rubber, you know, to put on the Model T.
Right.
So somebody had to provide the rubber. And then, hey, King Leopold was there. He had Congo, and Congo had rubber. And, you know, they had to produce rubber. And then if you didn't meet your quota, you're going to lose some arms.
You're going to lose some limbs. But what then happens is, again, people recognize that there are resources all over the Congo. The resources all over Africa. Mm-hmm. One of the richest continents. One of the richest pieces of land in the entire universe.
Yes.
Okay? So all that money is going to the king himself.
Exactly.
And so the Belgian government recognizes, yo, we want a piece of this too. They somehow finagle their way and get power away from Leopold. And so the Belgian government then controls.
Yeah. Congo. That was actually because the international community started to really come down on Leopold II because atrocities started to come out there.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, people too much became aware of it.
Yeah.
And it started looking really bad for Belgium itself. So they were able to come to a compromise, mm-hmm. in which he actually gives the Congo to the state of Belgium in 1908.
Okay. But what happens, and this is a pattern that repeats itself,
mm-hmm.
in any change of power,
mm-hmm.
post-colonialism, well, any change of power on the continent, unfortunately, mm-hmm. power is given on paper to the Belgian government, but the people who are administering the power are still loyal.
Yeah.
To King Leopold.
Exactly.
So really, how much is really changing?
Exactly. Nothing will change.
Yeah.
Because according to that exchange, it was because Belgium wanted now to change the issue going on in the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to make it a different Congo. But it just happened that once they got it, it just kept on going.
So again, so that change happened in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to fast forward to independent movements in the 50s and eventually 1960. What happens in 1960?
We'll start, let's say probably 1959,
yes.
where Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Congo, really...
Elected.
Yes.
He was elected by the people.
Elected by the people, yes.
And he was able to put the Congolese together as one people.
Okay.
Lumumba was pretty much a pro-United Congo.
Okay.
So therefore, he was able to unite the whole Congolese people, and he was elected, and the Congo finally got its independence in June 30th, 1960.
So the Belgians leave. Obviously, all the Belgian money leaves with them.
No, they did not leave. They said that they gave us independence. But which really, well, you know,
and this, yeah, listen to it.
Yeah.
Gave us independence.
We grant you.
Yeah.
We permit you to live in your own country as free men.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah.
Lumumba's speech, which stirred up the whole world.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because he got up there and said, no, we deserve this independence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we worked hard.
Yeah,
I mean,
we made sacrifices. We died. Men were whipped. We suffer because of it. We got called names. We got pretty much run to the ground in our own homeland. We got mistreated in our own country. So we earned this independence. You know, Belgium speak, when the king of Belgium spoke, it's like, you know, we are giving you this independence.
Right.
And Kasavubu, who was the president of Congo at the time, he agreed with
that. So explain that. So doing my research as well, there's a prime minister, for people who are not familiar with it, there's a prime minister, which was Lumumba, and then there's also a president. How does that work?
It's a little bit like monarchy, how you got a king, and then you got the prime minister. So pretty much you got a president, and you got the prime minister. So in this case,
who wields real power? President.
Mm-hmm.
So is that more of a figurehead, and then and then is the prime minister the one that's actually kind of doing?
He's the one who runs. He's pretty much who runs the government.
Okay. He runs the government.
He runs the government.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the president was just as a king.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so just, Lumumba was king. Kasavubu. The other
Kasavubu. Yeah.
Was
okay. Yeah, because putting Lumumba as a president at the time was definitely not a good idea.
To divide him?
Well, no, because of how powerful he was, because Lumumba never held his tongue. He believed in the sovereignty of the Congolese people, of any country as a matter of fact, where you are able to govern yourself without outside interference. I mean, we will deal with you, right. We will cooperate with you in different issues, but you will not come and tell us how to govern ourselves. We are a sovereign country, just like Belgium, just like France, just like the United States, just like any other countries. Those were his ideals that, you know, hey, we've got this independence, now we are going to start our own Republic of Congo right here, right now, by ourselves.
So what do you call that person in 1960? Call him a radical? And then what do you do with them if you're an outside force?
You get rid of them.
Get rid of them, which is what happens a year later.
And that is why being the prime, just to go back to...
Or a few months later, actually, not even a year later.
A few months later.
Being the prime minister was very important to Lumumba because he knew that he would pretty much have control of the government so that the Congo can really be a sovereign state. Instead of just being a president,
another puppet, to be another puppet, another puppet.
Exactly.
So independence in 60, duly elected by the people, and then in January 1961, a few months afterwards, killed.
January 17th, exactly.
Killed.
Yeah.
By whom?
Well, Lumumba's death, the Belgian government just came out last year.
And
apologized to the Congolese people for the death of Lumumba, for the involvement. The Americans came at the end of last year also to say, you know, Eisenhower was the one who ordered the hit.
I don't know if you've ever heard about the Church Committee, which was in charge of looking into the implication of the CIA into the death of Lumumba. Of course, the CIA does not deny the fact that they have tried, attempted many times to poison Patrice Lumumba using toothpaste. It was just that his entourage was very hard.
They were very loyal to him.
Okay.
Because they believed in what he believed in.
That's the only reason why the CIA was not able to
penetrate,
really neutralize Lumumba. But however, they play a big role in doing that. And for instance, you have President Mobutu, who was a CIA agent.
And I didn't know this until today.
Mm-hmm.
Mobutu was appointed by Lumumba as chief of staff of the army.
Yes!
I did not know that until today.
No, first before that he was his secretary. Because Mobutu was a journalist.
A journalist appointed by basically one of the pivotal figures in African liberation theory. And like you said, somebody who believes in the true meaning of democracy.
Yes.
Appoints the guy who ends up for the last 40 years more or less destroying the country. It's just an ironic thing.
Yes.
But at the same time, you have to understand that 1960, in January, you have the round table, which is the political round table. That's where all the politicians participated. But also there was the economic round table, which was to discuss the economy of the country.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, during that roundtable, the Congolese leaders, politicians, are not there. So what does Lumumba do? He sends Mobutu.
Yeah.
So Mobutu is there, and he pretty much knew everything
that was happening.
He's discussing the economy, he's discussing money.
And I believe that's where they started to cut deals with him.
Yes.
And this is one of the main reasons why.
When you say they, who are they?
The powers.
I will start with Belgium as one.
Yeah, the power. Yeah.
So again, it's not just a meeting. So when you say meeting, it's not a meeting between the different factions within the Congo.
Yeah.
It's meeting with European powers, U.S. powers, people that want a stake, as always, mm-hmm. in the resources that are now going to be in a so-called democratic Congo. That's
yes.
not free and open
yes.
for invasion economically by anybody else.
Yes, but exactly. but don't forget that this is the time after the World Wars, after the World War One, World War Two, and then Cold
people
War.
Need resources.
Don't forget that the U.S. already knew what was in the Congo, other than the rubber. Ask those who know about all those big bombs that are dropping in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. If you ask where they got the uranium for those bombs, they'll tell you where that came from.
Uranium came from the Congo.
Yes. No. There's so much in the Congo. And that's the reason why you CNN and CBS and Fox News and ABC and all these guys still don't want to talk about Congo today. Because
economic powers.
Because
businesses that you're affected.
They know how much Congo has, and they know how much just the market in the Congo can impact not exactly. the continent of Africa, but the entire world.
So would you say the same way that Saudi Arabia and this dynasty and the Saudi Arabian regime, I think they control 5% or more of the total world population.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to sort of kowtow and bow down to them. Not just the United States, but Western powers, because they control so much. It's that sort of same relationship in terms of, not oil, but all the other natural resources that are in the Congo, that you sort of have to kind of let, unfortunately, dictators and people that come up do their thing, because on the backside, you're getting the manganese, you're getting the uranium, you're getting all those things. You kind of let them be. We know the terrorists were supported by Saudis. We know they came from
of
there.
Of course.
We sort of turn a blind eye to it
because
we're getting the oil. So
yes.
Do you think it's the same sort of relationship that's going on?
It's worse than that, because Congo has more impact than Saudi Arabia. Because when you think about it today, when you wake up in the morning, when you just wake up in the morning, first, you see that cell phone that you have in your hand? You know the reason why it's mobile? You know the reason why you can get Wi-Fi, internet? You know why you're getting that? Because of coltan. You know what coltan is?
Columbine titanium, that's what it's short for.
Yes.
Which is 75% of it is found in the Congo.
It's found in the Congo, in the eastern Congo. Where more than,
which is the most divisive part of the country, where the most
where more than 12 million people have died in the past 20 years, and nobody wants to talk about it. That's the biggest genocide in the history of the world. The biggest genocide in the history of the world. But no one still wants more than 12 million. As the UN knows, because all these people are being killed under the nose of the UN. The UN is aware of it. More than 12 million people have died in the region. No one talks about it on the news.
You think big business is trying to keep people quiet?
They have to keep people business, because if they don't, your iPhone will be costing you $5,000. Yes. Seriously, your Samsung Galaxies, your iPhones, your Motorola's, your Sony, all these tablets that you see people holding in their hands now, all these cell phones, that's 75% of coltan that's found in the Congo is what's making those electronic devices.
And don't forget that the United States Army tremendously depends on the other natural resources
in the Congo.
There's a reason why the U.S.
Why?
Has the number one military. Because of the same natural resources that you can use
to make weapons,
sophisticated weapons.
Even your NASA program.
You know,
even NASA program to send people to the moon.
To go out of space. And exactly. And
so you're saying that, the infrastructure of modern society in terms of our communication networks, cell phone, anything that's been miniaturized to make our existence more enjoyable, more fun, a lot of that is coming from natural resources that are evident. Not just they're thinking that these things are in the Congo. Nobody's dug it, but they have been found in the Congo.
Yes, sir. Have you watched the movie Avatar?
Yeah.
You watched the movie Avatar. You know where the Na'vi people lived, correct?
Yeah.
Did you see that the natural resource that was found under their tree?
What is it? Unobtainium.
Exactly. So that's the story of the Congo. There are some a lot of parallels between that movie Avatar.
That's a good point.
And the history of the Congo.
That's a good point.
Because you see, all the natural resources were under the tree which was pretty much their habitation, their habitat. That's where they live. That's where they stay. But in order for them to get to the natural resource, what they had to do? They wanted to get rid of the whole tree, right? Mm-hmm. That's exactly what's happening.
Well, I think on a broader level, Avatar is a story about, I think, the destruction of the planet.
Yes.
Just not just in the Congo, but that we're just taking more from Mother Earth than we're putting in. but as the perfect example of it.
Yes.
And as he
went straight to the Congo.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's interesting. So watch Avatar again.
Yeah.
And that is the history of the Congo.
Netflix just released a documentary called Virunga. Mm-hmm. Also,
What's it called?
Virunga is the name of our park. It's a national park in eastern Congo. So now that I've just discovered that the whole park is on top of oil. They've discovered oil.
So there goes that park, by the way.
That's why you have all the rebel groups. That's why you have all this unrest in the eastern Congo. What happens is like whenever there's chaos, that's when they come in, when they start getting all these natural resources. They blame the locals, just like they blame the locals for the death of Lumumba, but at the same time, it's not the locals because Congolese don't manufacture weapons.
Right.
We don't manufacture weapons. We don't make guns, we don't make bullets, but we die from them.
War is a global economic phenomenon. War is a global economic phenomenon.
Chinese investment in sub-Saharan Africa has, over the last 10 or 15 years, you have an economy that's, probably number one in the world now, but it wants to stay that way. In order to do that, you need resources. There's not a whole lot of natural resources in China.
Yes.
So you have to go where they are, and where are they? They are in the
Congo.
They are in Africa, specifically
in the Congo.
In the Congo. So we're gonna continue with the little history lesson to bring people up to date, because you have to understand the history to understand what is going on now. So we're at 1961, Lumumba is assassinated. 1965, Mobutu Sese Seko, who was chief of staff of the army, appointed by Lumumba, takes over because there were 4 years of political unrest. There's 4 years of political unrest, there's destabilization. Mm-hmm. So what happens, somebody says, I will stand up and put all these people together, obviously secretly backed by the US, backed by European powers, backed by corporations. He comes into power.
Mm-hmm.
1965, 1971, changes the name to
Zaire.
Mm-hmm. And for 30 years, this man does what?
32 years,
what does this man do? Mobutu Sese Seko.
Pieces over the country.
He becomes exactly what King Leopold did. So you see, again, we have to understand what Leopold did, which we explained. And so you get Black Leopold, who instead of doing it from Belgium, is doing it in his own country to his own people for 32 years. So that brings us up to about
1997.
Yeah. Okay. So we have, again, I mean, you can go online and you can do your own research, but we're talking about a man who killed his own people. We're talking about a man who put money in his own pockets. We're talking about a man who supposedly said to his own army, why do I need to pay you? I give you weapons. Meaning, go out and get money out of your own. Which is, I mean, that is... Why do I need to pay you? People coming up to you, man, why you not paying us? Why do I need to pay you? I give you a gun, go get the money.
Yeah, exactly.
For the 30 years, Zaire was a failed state. There was no infrastructure, there was no army.
No,
there was exactly. There were people who were basically doing whatever they could to get by.
Yes.
There were people who had their own economy of scale just so their people can eat. Just
yes.
So their daughters and mothers can eat. And 30 years, they're doing stuff on their own, basically.
And they ate. And they did eat.
Because the mentality was, if you want to eat, that's for you.
Yeah, right.
It was pretty much the cult.
The cult of personality developed around Mobutu Sese Seko.
Yes, exactly. And it was the deity.
And if you're looking at this as the example, like they talk about during what happened in Iraq, you talk about what goes on in Abu Ghraib, where the American soldiers are dehumanizing these prisoners,
mm-hmm.
taking pictures of them and holding on to their balls and all this stuff. They're following the example of their leader, George Bush, who's doing the same thing. So if your leader is corrupt, if your leader is making decisions, if your leader is leading a war based on lies, what are the soldiers supposed to do? So if you have a country who is being led by a thief, everybody else becomes thieves.
Yes.
Exactly.
Everybody else becomes corrupt.
Yes.
Not because they want to, but it's the only way.
One of my uncles was a minister during one of the times of his presidency. And he told us this much. Mobutu sent one of his close buddies to go get the money in the bank. You would tell him and say, hey, I need you to go to the bank and get me $1 million. You will go to the bank and tell the director of the bank, I need $3 million.
And the director of the bank will go to the bank, say, I need $5 million.
Gotcha.
And the person, the director of the bank will send to get the money, say, hey, I need $7 million.
Gotcha.
So just as it goes, the person that the director send will pick up his $2 million.
Right.
When it gets to the doctor, you will get his $2 million. When it gets to the Mobutu's close by, they sent to the bank, you will get his $2 million. And when the money gets to Mobutu, it will be $1
million.
Gotcha. So, for most of the times, there was an inflation in the country because this guy printed so much money that we did not know. Dude, we used to walk around with a $50 million, like with a $50 million bill.
Get out of here.
$50 million.
So your mama says, Peter, can you go to the store to get me some milk? No. And you got $50 million.
So, but you know, it was so crazy that we started calling them lions because it was just millions, just too many millions. Mm-hmm. So instead of every time referring to a $20 million or $50 million, just, hey, I need about 10 lions. So that one, just to make it short, so that you know, you don't have to cost it a whole $100 million. Because then, you know, it's of course $100 million, you know, in any language sounds so big, so
right.
huge.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you get at $100 million, you go to the market, man, you come around with a piece of a dry fish.
You're both coming of age under Mobutu Sese Seko. Is that correct?
Yes.
You're growing up there. So what do you remember about that time? So we can, as intellectuals, talk about my game, the corruption, but what was it like? What was it like for you as a youth? I'll let the other gentleman speak here.
Yeah. And for my case, my father did a good job to not have us exposed out there to the reality.
Would you say that your family was middle class? Given the levels that were in the Congo at that point, or where were you economically? Because that affords a lot of privilege, that affords a lot of opportunity, that affords a lot of safety, depending on where you fit in the society.
Yes, we had the privilege to be higher than middle class.
Family had a car? That's the only thing. If your family had a car, you're rich.
We had cars.
Excuse me. King. I'm talking to a Prince Akeem here. He had two cars. Was your family go to the bank?
He was very entrepreneurial.
Okay.
You know, not only he worked as Secretary General of a big company.
Okay.
We had our own businesses. Okay. We had pharmacies. We had boutiques. He was also a teacher at a university.
Okay.
So we had that privilege. I actually attended one of the best private schools.
So we're talking suit and tie, the whole thing?
Not really, but like we all dress black and white.
Black and white, okay.
Black and white, but one of the best education in the country.
So looking back, do you feel that you were shielded in a way from a lot of what you now know as adult was really happening?
Yes, we...
Or did you see? What did you see, basically?
I haven't seen much. I knew that there was something going on out there,
mm-hmm.
but my father really kept us away from that. I remember 1992, I think, with the
looting.
The whole looting. We could hear outside, there's just bullets flying.
So what?
Everywhere.
So history. What happened in 92?
Unpaid soldiers. They wanted to be paid soldiers.
It's the same thing.
Mobutu told them to go pay themselves.
Pay themselves.
They wanted to break into all the stores.
That's what they did.
In the whole country. Well, that was not just in one city. That was all over the country.
And they started even going into people's houses.
Private homes.
It just happened that we had security in front of the house. That's why they couldn't enter our house.
Okay.
But we could hear what was going on outside.
Well, you were living well. You were living well.
And at night, if you look from the balcony, all you see is just as like shooting stars, but it's actually bullets flying.
You know, I don't really think about my past negatively, because I know it's what got me here.
But let's get this straight. You were not part of the ruling regime.
No, my father was.
As a matter of fact, your family was part of the opposition.
Yeah.
Okay.
And now I'm just hearing stories now that I've grown up that sometimes my father would spend a couple of days in jail.
Okay.
But we wouldn't know all that being young. Life owes me like an overdose. I'm slowly drifting into the arms of trouble, and trouble holds me, and nothing else is close to me more than pain. Unfortunately, like a self-fulfilling prophecy, I'm supposed to be struggling,
and it's troubling in the circumstances. And Peter, what about you? Memories?
I've had the privilege to live on both ends of the spectrum. You know, we had two cars. You know, I had a vehicle taking you to school and bring you back, and
I left the privileges. I went to stay where I didn't have those privileges.
And what, once the divorce happened, or?
Once the divorce happened, it was a struggle. Eventually, I ended up going back to my mother's father, who loved me dearly. He was like, you know, you'll be the boss now, you're gonna run all my business. He had this big truck, travel trucks that traveled, they carried merchandises from one side of the country to another. Okay. And so he was doing well, and on top of that, he had his own diamond mines. Because he's from the Kasai province where we have a lot of diamonds, so he had his own mines. He had people working on the mines for him. You know, he did not have to be there. You'll send people in the mines, they will work, catch diamonds, bring them to him, and you will go sell them, you know. And so he was really wealthy, so we had all that. And then one time, something happened, something really, really bad happened. This guy was working on the mines, got a big diamond. I mean, this diamond was going to get the
So we're getting into a blood diamond story here?
And again, we will talk about blood diamond, because those who, the whole concept of blood diamond and diamond, you know, we'll talk about that. If, you know, if we got time, we'll talk about it, because that's just like everything else that they make black, everything black look bad and everything white look good. It's kind of the whole blood diamond thing.
We have to make this a series.
This is just part one.
Yeah.
I thought I could cut this to about 45 minutes, add about 5 minutes of music.
Man.
But this is part one.
Yeah.
We haven't even gotten to the conflict. What's going on? Because no, and there's a reason for that, because the history is so deep.
Yeah.
And in order to understand the present, what's going on there now, you have to have some sort of historical context.
Yeah, you have to.
And you also, I think, you have to, as a storyteller, somebody who likes telling stories, likes listening to stories, likes writing stories, you've got to feel something for the people. And I think by this point, I know who I'm talking to, and I hope as an audience in podcast land on the internet, you have an idea of the kinds of people that we're talking to here. Two very intelligent, very aware human beings who are not afraid to share their history and who understand the context in which they lived, where they came from, and how that history affected them and what their responsibilities are to that moving forward. So. Absolutely, man. If this got to be three parts, it's got to be three parts, because I want to tell the tale. This sort of conversation is why I really wanted to do this kind of stuff. Well, what if we just finish up the history, because we got. So we go from King Leopold, just as we go from King Leopold, 1885, just some dates, to 1908, exactly. Where Belgian government basically takes over Congo.
Mm-hmm.
So we go to 1960, Lumumba's elected. 1961, Lumumba's assassinated. 1965, Mobutu Sese Seko takes over, rules for 32 years of just brutality, cult of personality, thievery. So we're up to about 1997.
Yeah.
And again, before that, because there's such a time in what happens in Rwanda.
Yeah,
exactly.
So okay, so before we get to 1997, again, all this stuff is just, where the regions around Central Africa, their histories and their politics is so intertwined, it's unbelievable. And then once you dig deeper, you recognize a lot of it is just, I'm just making the money sign right now. It's about resources, it's about access to resources. So in 1994, I'm a senior in high school, and in the spring of 1994, I start reading these accounts, these stories in the New York Times about what's going on in Rwanda, the genocide that's going on March, April in Rwanda. And just a little background, at the time, there are three ethnic groups, if you would, in Rwanda. The major two are the Hutu and the Tutsi. In 1994, prior to that, Hutu were the ruling class. But before we say that, you also have to understand that the history of Rwanda, kind of the same thing, Belgium's involved, Germany's involved. During the colonial era, let's just arbitrarily say the 1920s, to sort of create a political infrastructure, the Belgians and the Germans gave control, if you would, to the Tutsi class. So during the colonial era, Tutsis were in power. Belgium again starts abandoning Africa late 1950s, right? Before they leave, and I basically equate it to this. Tutsis were the house niggas, and the Hutus were the field niggas. Basically, the Hutus were the ones that were on the field, doing the war, the cattle farmers, the cattle herders, the people who were making the country go. And the Tutsis were more or less the folks that were sitting back ruling.
Yeah.
At least that's what is portrayed in history. Mm-hmm. So the Belgians, they leave, and they just flip it. They say, now, well, I mean, obviously there's a growing sentiment all that time, Hutus want power, they feel that they, first of all, they're the majority of the population.
Yeah.
And they feel they have they need to have power. It just seems fair that they should have power. So they've been lobbying for power. Priests get behind them, and everybody's sort of sympathizing with them. So when the Belgians leave in the mid to late 50s, they hand the Hutus the power. So for the entire colonial era, you're ruled by the Tutsis.
Mm-hmm.
And now the colonizers now say, well, I'm going to pop you up, and y'all are going to be in power. So what's going to happen to the Tutsis now? They're going to get run out. They feel, look, we've been ruling y'all field niggas for 80 years. Now y'all field niggas are taking over. We got to get the F out of here because y'all are going to do some shit to us. So the Tutsis leave. And what do they flee to? They flee to Eastern Congo.
Exactly.
They flee to Burundi. They flee to all those republics in Central Africa. Tutsis are in Eastern Congo, which Peter said, well, there's a lot of the incredibly horrific stuff is happening in that area, ultimately over the control of resources, but just as a historical perspective. So the Tutsis, and I was in Eastern Congo, the Hutus are in power. So the Hutus are in power, and every now and again, there's what they call ethnic cleansing. They're looking for Tutsis to, they want to rid Rwanda of Tutsis. So we fast forward from, let's say 1960 or so, to 1994, where there is almost a program in place. We are going to get rid of all the Tutsis. And they begin to do that. 800,000 lives lost in the matter of about 120 days.
Mm-hmm.
800,000 people dead. Tutsis that are now in Eastern Congo go like, we ain't standing for this. So they develop an army backed by
the United States.
At the time, I think.
At the time, really, the Congo really, and that's another mistake on Mobutu's behalf, really, because he did not get involved as much as he should have been involved in the whole process. Because you got something that's happening right now. You know, he's had problems there before.
Mm-hmm.
Mobutu did not think it was going to be that much of a deal.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, I've dealt with this before. You know, I'm going to crush that. I'm going to handle it. So he's dealt with it for so long, he was so confident, hey, that's not gonna be, it's just another one of those political unrest, or like you said, like one of those ethnic cleansing again, right. It's gonna stop and everything will go back to normal. He did not quite pay as much attention to it as he should.
And neither did anybody in the world. I think the United States government, they refused politically to make a statement and use the word genocide in any of its political documents. So just to finish up that, Hutus cleanse Tutsis. Tutsis are in Eastern Congo, we ain't standing for that. They go back.
Mm-hmm.
Overthrow the Hutu government. So where are those Hutus going to go now? They're going to go to Eastern Congo.
Exactly.
They're going to flee to Eastern Congo. So now in Rwanda, you had the second flipping of government. It was Tutsis were in charge during colonialism. Belgians put Hutus in charge. So in 1994, there's a flip based on the war. Tutsis win the war, so they're now in power. Hutus are out of power. Hutus go to Eastern Congo. But then you also have Tutsis are in Eastern Congo. So you have people that are hating each other historically,
mm-hmm.
that are now all in this one part of the Eastern Congo. And like you said, your man is not paying attention to it because he's worried about his $11 trillion
and his properties all over the world.
Okay. Yeah. So that happens. Tutsis are now in control in Rwanda. There's this boiling political unrest in the Eastern Congo that your guy is not paying attention to. And he's basically thinking it's going to go away. But then you have the Tutsis who recognize that they're now in control, but why should we stop in Rwanda? Let's get some tanks and let's ride all the way to Kinshasa. In part two, Peter and Yedidier talk about what happened when those tanks rolled into Kinshasa, led by former president Laurent Kabila, and how his son, the present ruler of Congo, Joseph Kabila, came into being. They build a case for why Joseph needs to be ousted as leader of the Congo, a sentiment which seems to be echoed by the 77 million people now inhabiting the country, and the thousands protesting every day, and the hundreds dying right now.